category E6 Sports Broadcaster of the Year, Jer Gilroy.
The notion that Lance is allowed to compete in the Tour of Australia, the Grand Tour of Australia, and make millions of dollars over a 3-year period, which now the New South Wales government are trying to get back off him, that happens on your watch. You allow him back in 2006 early.
We allowed him back 10 days early because he had come into the biological passport and he had his profile was a normal profile, so he was competing on the same level as everybody else. And I'll also add that John Fahey, president of WADA, made public statements at that time saying, this is wonderful, this is a phenomenal sportsman, and he's done huge amounts of work for charity and so forth. He was president of WADA, and he said that in 2009. So where was all the certainty that Lance Armstrong was doping then? When the president of WADA himself welcomed him back into Australia.
I'm really glad you brought that up, Pat, because when you mentioned that on prime time, I thought that's an incredible thing for John Fahey to have said at the time. Yeah. And it took me a long time to track down exactly what he said and the full text of the press conference. In the same press conference, John Fahey also says that Lance Armstrong has incredibly serious questions to answer about doping, particularly from the period of 1999 to 2005. And the comments that you're attributing to him are specifically about his ability to attract people to watch the race and to raise money for cancer. Mm-hmm. It's nothing to do with about him being a clean rider. He said that Lance could answer all those questions by simply allowing us to test the values that we have from 1999 to 2005. So it's an incredible spin to put on what John Fahey said in 2009 to say he welcomed him back with open arms, when in fact he was raising red flags out the door about the fact that Lance was a doper from 1999 to 2005 and didn't really welcome him back.
There's no... when you talk about 1999, those samples that were there in 1999 could not be tested for open up a process.
Lance could have had them tested if he had allowed to have them tested.
No, he couldn't, because they were used for research and they hadn't followed the protocols that were there. And had WADA been able to open up a process against Armstrong, they would have done so, but they didn't.
No, they needed him to volunteer. That was the point that Fahey was making.
No, they didn't need him to volunteer. Those samples were left there for research purposes. The testing that was done on them wasn't done with the protocols that would be done for a positive test. And so, therefore, they were invaluable from that point of view.
You've got to accept that the spin you're putting on John Fahey welcoming Lance Armstrong back is ludicrous, considering John Fahey and WADA actually had been telling everybody that there were red flags raised and that actually the UCI weren't doing enough throughout this period. It goes to the core of your bad relationship with Dick Pound to the point where you, in fact, instigate legal action against him.
Yeah, we did. Dick Pound was making allegations against the UCI, which were completely wrong. I invited Dick Pound to the UCI offices when I became president. We sat down and we showed him all the work we did. And he went out and retracted some of the things he publicly said.
He denies that he retracted them. He kind of qualifies them. I mean, that's certainly the statement that he issued and has subsequently said, is that he didn't retract them. But that whole point about your relationship with the anti-doping authorities, given that in 2005 the Armstrong lie is the lead story in Lakeep, and everybody is suspicious of him, but you guys haven't paid attention to what Betsy Andreo said, you haven't paid attention to David Walsh's book, you haven't called Emma O'Reilly in for any chats, you don't actually ring these people up and ask them what is the story. You don't think that a truth and reconciliation idea at that stage is of any value, because Lance Armstrong is too big a star.
Not in the least. you're completely wrong with inviting people in. We have invited people in. The problem is, we're not a police force. We're an international federation and an anti-doping agency, so to speak, as well. We have invited people in, and like, for instance, we had Tyler Hamilton in, and we told him we're watching him, his blood values, or there's something funny going on with his blood values. Now, this again was before my time. He turns around and said, well, there must be something wrong with your machines. I'm not doing anything. Later to be proven wrong. But the problem is, and when we invite people in, which we have done, it's his word against his, or his word against hers. And Emma O'Reilly, prior to, she stood up as a witness in the SA insurance case and lost, as did Betsy Andre and so forth. They lost, so therefore what was the point in UCI then bringing them in? We weren't going to be able to do anything with the information which was already beaten in a court.
Well, you could have asked. I mean, you could have got that record, got that information on the record. That's one thing, but okay, I accept, right? So you've decided that other people have done this and we're not going to ask those questions and we're not going to make any more of this. But then when Lance comes back you allow him to come back early? Like, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, the 2005 issue in particular, at that point, he retires and L'Équipe say that they know that he was on EPO and subsequently are proven right. But at the time, you're saying, oh, L'Équipe are trying to damage cycling.
No, because they said, it's all very well knowing somebody's doing something. But unless you can get the valid proof to be able to open up a case and prosecute them...
You have to look for it. You have to look for that proof.
We did look for it.
Where did you
We did look for it. We target tested Armstrong. I mean, he was tested 200 times, negative every time. And during the period, for instance, 2001 to 2005, USADA tested him 12 times.
Yeah, he was mostly living in Girona and competing at that stage, though.
No, he lived 6 or 7 months of the year in America.
The most important time is when he's living in Girona, when actually the doping is on. According to, anyway, the subsequent emails which we've seen from Michele Ferrari, and his relationship with Ferrari was also a red flag in the midst of all this, Pat, but there's no sense that you could even ban Michele Ferrari from cycling when that's within your charter. You are actually entitled to do that.
Exactly. When riders... we're not a police force. And we can't throw people out of sport with no reason. Otherwise, we end up in court. We have to have reason to throw them out.
But there was plenty of reason about Lance. It seems as if you have been very unsuccessful in your application of anti-doping, in a way that USADA, for example, was able to have a 2-year investigation into this, talk to witnesses, put all the evidence together, ask experts independently to get into this. So following that logic through, there's no way the UCI can be, at this point, legitimately not accused of having a conflict of interest when it comes to anti-doping. You have to separate anti-doping from the UCI. And that's one of the key tenets of Cookson's campaign, and it's one that Greg LeMond agrees with, and it's one that's generally gaining currency at the moment. But we haven't heard you say that this is the right thing. You still want to control anti-doping.
We work within the rules. What Cookson is saying is outside the rules. It's not allowed. The WADA code states that every international federation is responsible for the anti-doping in its international events. That's what the WADA code states. So you can't do it independently.
The rules are a very handy excuse when they haven't actually... you didn't catch Lance Armstrong. They didn't work. You didn't catch Lance Armstrong. On your watch, Lance Armstrong doped.
Hold on a second. I would love to hand out anti-doping. Every international federation would love to hand out anti-doping to an independent group. The rules don't allow us to do it.
But change the rules.
It's such the WADA to change the rules, not the UCI.
But there's been no indication from you that you're interested in doing that.
Oh no, I've made many statements saying we'd love to get rid of anti-doping many times.
A couple of questions about your own game. Who taught you how to be a striker and who taught you how to be a goal scorer? When did you acquire this?
When I was a kid, I started off as a right back, and then just for the first year, you know, when you're young, you just play anywhere. So I remember I was taking the corners and free kicks and penalties, everything from right back, and then my uncle took over the team the next year and just moved me straight up front, you know.
And then that was a good decision.
Yeah, and just since then, so it's actually Jason Bourne who's my cousin. He was, you know, one of the greatest goal scorers in the Irish League. His father, so he moved me up front, and then I just, you know, continued on just to score goals from there. So.
But in terms of movement and where to go and where to stand, because again, recently I read an interview where you said that sometimes the best thing and most important thing is to stand still.
Yeah, I said that. Sometimes that can be the case, but I mean, don't just stand still just for the whole 90 minutes and expect the ball. You know, sometimes you have to. You know, it's a bit cat and mouse, I think, with the defenders. You know, you have to use your head and. You know, sometimes you can make a run and just stop and just stand there for a second. You watch like Messi sometimes, he walks sometimes, you know, but then he gets on the ball and then he's gone again, you know. So it's about using your head, you know. It's playing against anybody, and it is certainly as a striker, and if you're playing against a defender, it's just creating that yard of space. It's all you need, a yard, 2 yards, and anybody that gets the ball with nobody around them is great. Someone who's right up your backside and trying to tackle you. You know, of course, it's going to be harder for yourself. By creating space for yourself and a bit, just a little bit of movement here and there, you know, will fool the defender, and it gives you the opportunity to have time on the ball.
Do all your managers automatically understand that that's your game, or do some managers say, "Well, this style of play that we're going to have requires you to be in certain places at certain times"?
No. The manager only give you a job to do on the field. You know already what. Which way that you play and which way that you'll fit into the role. So now my game is always been the same. You can't just change someone's game. Of course you can give them give them pointers and give them tips of what you wanted to do, or you know, where you want to, if you want to mark the holding midfielder, for example, stuff like that. But regarding movement, that's your own judgment. But you can certainly help certainly younger players, you know, give them a couple of little tips here and there, and then that will stay in their head, you know. And if they are 14, 15, 16, you know, when they are playing in professional, that will certainly help them.
And you seem to enjoy that part of the game as well, actually, being someone who has that responsibility to say to somebody, here's a bit of advice, take it if you want to, take it if you don't, it's up to you.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful, I think, when especially with younger kids, you know, I think you have to be careful, you know, feeding them too much information, you know. I think one or two little pointers here and there, you know, as a striker, you know, I tend to, you know, speak to strikers if I'm watching a game or something, look at them and, you know, give them a couple of little tips here and there, but nothing major, just about little small movements, as I said, that would create space for you and give you an opportunity to, you know, to get a chance on goal, to hold the ball up and get someone else and bringing someone else into play. So, no, I certainly enjoy doing that. You know, but I think when you're 10 years of age and stuff like that, it's about enjoying yourself, you know, and letting kids enjoy themselves as well, and not the parents getting involved too much and on the sideline screaming and shouting, telling the kids what to do, because, you know, kids always want to please the father, you know, and then you got the father on the shoulder shouting, telling them what to do, you know, and rather than him enjoying his football, because you could, with father shouting at them and stuff like that, or mothers, whoever, you know, they could have a hidden little gem in there, you know, that just wants to relax and enjoy himself. But they got, you know, trying to please, you know, the folks all the time, that, you know, sometimes that can be hard. So any parents listening to this, don't shout at your kids. So that's why you have coaches to help them, you know.
Yeah,
it's nothing worse as a manager. I'm involved in younger age athletic care and stuff like that, you know. I'm the president of the club there, so, and my brother and everyone's involved, and it's nothing worse when, you know, they're coaching, some of the lads are coaching, and there's other parents on the sideline screaming and shouting at the kids to do this and do that, you know. I don't think it helps the kids, to be honest with you.
No, it definitely doesn't. The World Championships, you've come into us on crutches. Obviously, no one knows that because this is radio. But
crutch. Singular.
Sorry.
I'm getting better.
You've hobbled in because you did your cruciate.
Yes, cruciate and meniscus, yeah.
How did that happen?
That was the team spar on the last day.
Do a kick in someone?
Well, I was travelling towards kicking someone. I actually still have it on video. It's a sickening sight.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
What's that experience like watching back? The bit where you go,
oh, my stomach kind of, you know, turns a bit when I see it. But, you know, when I see it again, it also makes me realise the mistake I did with the positioning of my feet and to not do it again. So
that's a harsh lesson.
Yes, it is. And I watched it again and again, and it won't happen again. So that's the best things to learn from your mistakes. So.
You won 3 goals at this year's Euros.
Yes.
That was back in April. So what we're talking about, the injury that happened, was in October at this year's World Championships.
Mm-hmm.
It happened after you'd already won the gold at the individual.
Yes, a day after, yeah.
Okay, so, and just to repeat, you won 2 goals. So you've won 1 goal, this injury happens, and then, despite the injury, you go on to win a 2nd goal.
Yeah.
How the hell does that happen?
I don't know. God, when I look at the video of that action happening, it's pretty unbelievable. But at the time, there are four people on the team for power, and there's three different techniques is to be broken, and there's one reserve. God forbid anything should happen. We were all, the three that were on, were the most experienced, and it was my duty to complete that because I know how to do that very well, and our reserve didn't have as much experience. So I basically just had to mentally block it off.
Power is, as you explained to us a little earlier, you've actually got to break a block of wood.
Yeah. It's like 2 inches thick of wood, 2 behind each other. So you have to break it with one single technique. And so my technique is by using the outside of my hand, of right here. And the other one is with your foot, and the other one is with the ball of your foot. And the 2 girls broke theirs after I broke mine. And there was a incredible roar from the crowd when it happened, because everyone knew my situation, but it was kind of kept quiet because, you know, it was a very intense moment. If you address the issue, even psychologically, especially psychologically, you know,
you're screwed.
If you allow it to screw you. Yeah,
yeah.
You would be, but I didn't. And
so just to repeat, you did your cruciate, and then an hour later you went out and won 1 goal by breaking two inch blocks of wood with your bare hands.
Yeah, and I met people in the airport the next day, actually, from other teams who had, you know, been breaking on those boards also, and the same wood, and they had broken their arms and things like that. And it was just, I really feel, it was just like a pure like, adrenaline to just get it done for my team, you know. So that's really what it was.
That's pretty hardcore.
Hard anyway.
Yeah.
It was incredible. It was incredible. And watching it back is lovely as well. Because after me, after I did my break, the two girls followed through with theirs, and it was just, that was magnificent.
We see golfers and the microphones are so powerful. We get to hear when you bang the club off the ground, or when, you know, when there's any of that kind of, any little frisson of anger comes out, we see it because the cameras are on you the whole time. Can you now accept that you're going to be a golfer who plays in streaks, that you're not going to be a Steve Stricker top 10 every time you play?
Yeah, I'd love to be, you know, I'd love to be a little more consistent, and I'm working towards trying to have that consistency. But I mean, if that means that, you know, if I don't want to settle. I don't want to settle for someone that's streaky, and when he's hot, he's hot, and when he's off, he's off. You know, I'd rather, you know, have my bad golf get better, and obviously keep my good golf the same, because I know my good golf's good enough to win the best tournaments in the world. So I think it's about just making your misses better, and making, you know, turning those 75s and 76s into respectable rounds, and that obviously makes a huge difference. But you know, I don't want to be known as a player that's just streaky, and when he's hot, he's really good. I want to be a person that's up there week in, week out.
So you want your streaks to last much longer, and the bad ones to be, you can still be in contention.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what Tiger Woods has done so well for the last...
I was going to say, you're not asking for much here.
No, not at all. But, you know, that's what Tiger Woods has done well for the last 15 years. His great golf is obviously good enough to win any week he plays. And even when he's not on top of his game, he still finds a way to get himself into contention.
You've been talking a good bit with Tiger, obviously, the film and ads together. It seems like there's a genuine warmth between you. Golf is kind of a funny sport in that everybody who plays on the tour is actually, while they're competing with each other, they're all still helping to build the brand of golf and its relationship with the rest of the world. And the better everybody plays, the better it is for everybody. So you can be very competitive with somebody, but at the same time, you can still have a friendship with them.
Definitely. You know, golf is a... You know, there's a lot of sportsmanship and respect, and it's actually something that I was talking to President Clinton about today. You know, you can be going down the stretch with, even with a guy that you don't like, a guy that you want to, you know, you wouldn't want anything more than to beat him, you know, at, you know, the final round of a major. But at least at the end of it, after you both hold your putts on 18, you shake hands and you walk off. And okay, you might be friends, but, you know, it's still respectful, and it's still show a little bit of sportsmanship. And it's one of the only sports that it really happens.
Do you get to talk to people like Tiger about stages of your career? Like, I mean, obviously he's been through an awful lot himself, and there were definitely times in Tiger's career where I thought he wasn't fully enjoying being Tiger Woods, that the toll of being Tiger was actually taking a toll on him. And I'm not even talking about the personal life stuff, just the fact that, like, he had to win. The expectation was so great every time he was on the golf course, that's not an easy thing, and that very few of us ever really get to understand that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think in a way he's a victim of his own success. He set the bar so high. And, you know, everyone's expectations of him are to go out and win every week he plays. And, you know, it's just not possible. You know, human beings, we, you know, make mistakes, and, you know, we're not robots, we're not machines. And, you know, it's, you know, I don't envy his position. You know, I think being Tiger Woods at times is very testing in terms of, you know, the intrusion in his life. And you know, it's very hard for him to go and walk down the street, or, you know, go to the cinema with his kids, or to do any of that stuff. You know, it's very, very difficult. And, you know, I definitely don't envy that part of his life.
It's kind of getting to that point for you, though. Like, I mean, I know, for example, that you had dinner recently in a restaurant with Wayne Rooney, because I read about it in the newspaper. I saw the picture of you and Bono and Bill Clinton yesterday because somebody tweeted it out. Everywhere you go, there is still that kind of same level of attention. How do you deal with that?
You just get used to it. You know, it's part and parcel of life now. And I mean, that sort of stuff's fine, because, you know, you're in places where, you know, I had dinner in Manchester with Wayne Rooney, you know, and he, you know, Manchester United, and I mean, he's going to be recognisable. If it was just me and some of my friends in that restaurant, it probably wouldn't have been the same attention. You know, exact same. You know, I'm eating dinner with President Clinton and Bono last night at Civet. You know, if it was just me and my family in there, obviously the attention wouldn't be as great. But it's part of life, and it's not a bad problem to have. You know, it's, you know, you welcome it, and you know you're doing something right if you have that attention.